Okay, thanks for inviting me here. And also thanks to showing up here in the morning after the conference dinner. And a third thanks to my collaborators, in particular Philip Gerichides and my PhD student Andrea Gatto and Simon Glover. Okay, so I'm going to take you a little bit to larger scales again, of a couple hundred parsec, where we basically study the interstellar medium in disk galaxies, for example, Milky Way type galaxies, which I want to focus on today. And so if we want to understand what is the cycle of gas in such a normal galaxy, then actually we have to span quite a broad range in scales and also in physics, which is involved here. So first of all, we start out with a spiral galaxy seen here face on, and if we want to understand, look at where is two stars form, we have to zoom into one of these gas-dominated regions, where we find on a scale of a couple hundred parsec a picture of a multi-phase ISM, which is very structured, has cold dense regions and warm rarefied regions. And then in the end, stars form on much, much smaller scales. So we have to zoom into a couple 50 AU or a couple AU scales where we actually see to have collapse in star formation, as Norm just described very nicely. And so if we are lucky, and usually you have, if you turn 100 solar masses of gas into stars, you're lucky about one time, and you form a massive star, which then affects the surrounding by ionizing radiation, stellar winds, and supernova feedback, as we've already seen during the past 2 days. And so here we have basically the cooling and collapse regime where we go down the scales, we go to very high densities and cold temperatures. And then here we start to, the massive stars start to affect their environment by the feedback processes, and we start to go back up the scales from subparsec to, again, parsec scales in the case of H2 regions, and to 100 parsec scales even. And then finally, when we have supernova explosions, we start to affect large volumes in the disk and to drive gas out of the disk in galactic outflows. And so this is basically this whole life cycle of the clouds. So now, trying to understand this in a simulation requires to span a really broad range in temperatures and densities. And I stole this slide here from Ed Jenkins, Jack Jenkins, because I liked it a lot. So here, the hot interstellar medium is at temperatures above 10 to the 6 or so in Kelvin, and very low number densities, about 10 to the minus 2. And so here, this gas is in a typical old picture by McKee and Oestreicher, is coming from supernovae, which are heating up the gas locally. And this phase here makes up a large fraction of the volume in the galactic disk in the ISM. And so then we have an intermediate phase at 10 to the 4 Kelvin, where we kind of have a stable regime in the cooling curve. And this is at number densities of around 1 or so. And as we go to number densities of higher than 10 to the 2, we have the CNM. We have diffuse atomic and molecular gas at below 300 Kelvin. So 300 Kelvin is the typical temperature below which you have a stable cold phase in the ISM. And so I just talked about this huge temperature regime. How does it come upon? Well, in the end, we have to consider metallicity-dependent heating and cooling processes. And I took this figure from Dardano and McRae. I like it very much because it shows what processes are most important in which regime. Here's the cooling rate as a function of temperature. And you can see that in the high temperature regime, it's mostly metal line cooling which is dominating. So here we have O6, for example, and so on. And then as we go to temperatures around 10 to the 4, here we have Lyman alpha cooling. And at lower temperature, it's mostly C+ fine structure emission and dust thermal emission as we go to even lower temperatures. On the other hand, we also have heating. And so we had this talk yesterday by Karen about the photoelectric emission from dust, which depends on the dust properties. And so this might actually change. In our models, we assume a very simple dust-to-gas ratio of 1 to 100, so the typical one, and the normal dust composition. So then we also have H2 photodissociation heating. We have the interstellar radiation field, X-ray ionization, cosmic ray ionization, and then we also have kinematic effects. If you have dynamically evolving system, you also have PdV work and shock heating, which is important. And so, well, here you can basically say, okay, we can, from this picture, we can distinguish, as I just showed you in the slide before, our interstellar medium into different temperature regimes. But in the end, what you see in the observations is different chemical species, right? So you have, so this is from taken from the Planck 1 Euro Sky Survey, and in the blue you see H1 gas, and overlaid here, so superimposed, is the CO survey by Dame et al. And you can see that the CO, so the dense molecular gas, is concentrated to the disk midplane, whereas the H1 gas is much more extended. So in the end, what you see in the observations are chemical species rather than really the temperature regimes. And later on during the talk, I will show you the difference that we actually, it makes a difference if you divide up by temperature regime or if you really look at the chemical species. But this requires us to model the chemistry self-consistently in the simulations. And this is what we did. So basically, in a chemical reactive flow, you have the different species. They satisfy an equation where they are affected. They can be created and also destroyed with certain rates, and the rates here are given by the chemical network, which by the heating and cooling processes which are going on. And so we implemented a small chemical network into the flash code, and usually chemical equations are very stiff, so you have to solve them with implicit schemes, and in this case we use we solve them iteratively using the DBODE solver. And in the end, our chemical network allows us to follow the H2 formation, also on dust, and the conversion directly from C+ to CO, following this model by Nelson and Langer in 1997. This is a simplified model. So basically, we don't have atomic carbon here, which is discussed in a 2 years later on paper. To have more, to also have atomic carbon basically requires you to have quite a number of more chemical reactions in there. And so for now, we have only this simplified method of forming CO. But so we can extend this in the future. Okay. So what is also important for molecule formation is that they like to hide behind high column densities. And because otherwise, they're easily dissociated again, right? By, for example, the interstellar diffuse radiation field. And so we have to take into account the shielding of molecules coming from the total column, as well as for H2, for example, molecular hydrogen self-shielding and CO self-shielding. So there are a few components which are important here. And this, in order to treat these shielding effects, it requires us to treat diffuse radiation in the simulations. And so basically, we do this in a very simplified approach. In the end, we neglect the emissivity in every cell. We neglect the source function. And we just take into account that the specific intensity is a function of the local column density within which we are. So this is what we take. And basically now we can, if we know for every cell in our volume or for every SPH particle, depending on what you are using, what numerical scheme, we need to know how deeply embedded is the cell. So we compute the column densities along an, a unit sphere, basically assuming a certain number of rays. We do this with the Hill-Pix algorithm. So you can see here the lowest number of Hill-Pix pixels you have. Hill-Pix basically is an equal area isolatitude pixelation, and the lowest number of pixels you can have is 12, and then you go up to 48 and so on. So we did some convergence studies here. It turns out that usually 48 is good enough, so you don't need to do much more. So, okay, so this is has been published by Clark and Glover in 2012. And we coupled it to the tree gravity, which is implemented into the flash code by Richard Wünsch. And so now for every cell at every time, we compute the column density, we compute the self-shielding, and couple that to the chemical network in the simulation in order to do the molecule formation and destruction. And I show you a test now for just a periodic box. where we drive turbulence. So this is where a simple setup here. You see the density, the temperature, the H2 abundance, and the CO abundance, which comes out. And you can see that we form high density regions, which are cold, and then they become molecular. So you can see that the structures here are traced very nicely in the molecular gas, which are in the density and cold in the temperature. Okay, so is this actually important to go at these great lengths into dealing with the diffuse radiation? Yes, it is. So I did these turbulent box runs here once without the treacle and once with the treacle. And this is what you can see here. So this is the mass fraction of molecular hydrogen as a function of time, mass fraction of CO as a function of time in these boxes. And the red line is without the treacle algorithm, so without self-shielding. And the black lines is with self-shielding. And you can see that the difference here in mass fraction, molecular gas mass fraction we get is about 2 orders of magnitude and even more for the CO abundance. Okay, so you really have to take this into account if you want to get the molecular gas right. So Glover did the 6-ray approximation before, and this one is better because it's faster, actually. So the 6-ray was much slower even than what we are doing here, because you are doing the tree walk already, so it's not so bad. This is just to show you the comparison to observational data. A good thing to look at here is the H2 column as a function of the total column. And again, so for the turbulent boxes, we did this. The black points are from the simulation, and overplotted here is observed data from Savage et al. 1977 and Wolfer et al. In 2008. So you can see that our model actually does the right thing. Okay, so now we have implemented the methods to actually study cooling and collapse in our bigger simulation, which we want to do. Now, on the other hand, we also have stellar feedback. And today, I want to concentrate on supernova feedback, because this already turned out to be quite interesting. So what happens if we have a supernova feedback? Now, let's first focus on supernovae, which are actually interacting with dense molecular clouds, which we discussed yesterday, probably 1/4 or so of them do. So here, we did a couple of very high resolution simulations in dense molecular clouds. So basically, we started with a dense molecular cloud, number density of 100. So the total mass was 10 to the 5 solar masses, and the radius is about 16 parsec. So in the end, if you do these larger scale SPH simulations, this is one of your SPH particles, I guess, right? About that order. So let's see what happens inside such a molecular cloud if we have a supernova exploding in the center of it. And so we also try to disentangle what's the effect of having no structure, so a homogeneous cloud, and having substructure, for example, in a fractal cloud. And also, what is the effect of having just a supernova explosion going off in there, or having first the massive star ionizing the cloud and then a supernova explosion going off? Well, in the end, what we wanted to find out is how much momentum is put into the surrounding cold gas by the supernova explosion, because in the end, that's what you get out. So we found that the energy varies a lot. So kinetic energy, thermal energy is not a good measure. So I think, as Eve, you also put in momentum in your model. So momentum seems to be a much more well-defined quantity, because once you leave the set of Taylor phase, which is very short here in these dense clouds, it's about 10 kiloJoules or so, and then you're already dominated by cooling. So once you leave the set of Taylor phase, your momentum stays constant as a function of time. And so if you can't resolve the set of Taylor phase, it's much safer to put in momentum rather than anything else like energy and so on. So also one point here, since the set of Taylor phase is so short in these high-density clouds, it's really bad if you switch off cooling for a longer time, because that gives you a completely different answer. That would basically compare to having an adiabatic explosion going on for a short amount of time. And so what I show you here is the amount of momentum you get at just 0.2 megajoules after the explosion. But this seems to be in the phase. So here you have the time. At 0.2 megajoules, we are usually well into the regime where the momentum stays constant. unless we have an adiabatic explosion. So this is the case of an adiabatic explosion in a homogeneous cloud. So here the momentum is still increasing a bit. So we did a number of simulations, a lot of them actually. So here we have homogeneous clouds, we have the Fraxel clouds. These different simulations are A means that it's an adiabatic simulation, so no cooling. C, the blue points are for simulations with radiative cooling. And if we have pink points, then they have had ionizing radiation affecting the cloud before the supernova went off. Okay. So now you can see that clearly in the adiabatic cases, you get way more momentum input than in any of the other cases here. So in fact, what you get is you can compute what you should get in the adiabatic case is about a factor of 80 compared to what you put in initially. So here you're well above what you would have if you really include radiative cooling. Then what you can also see is that so the pink points are typically higher than the blue ones, which means that the initial ionizing radiation helps the supernova to affect the cloud and to put more momentum into it. So here basically what you get is a factor of 16 or so more than the initial momentum. And at this point, we are in a regime where we have a few times 10 to the 5 in solar masses times kilometers per second in momentum. So basically it means that you can accelerate a few times 10 to the 5 solar masses to 1 kilometer per second. Okay. And then we also studied if it's more effective to have two supernova explosions, one after the other, because, I mean, a lot of the massive stars seem to be in binary, so you can have a second supernova explosion shortly after the other one, and then it's like having a super bubble expanding. However, again, here, it seemed that the ionizing radiation actually was more effective than having a second supernova explosion. Okay. So this basically motivated us to include into the larger scale simulations a scheme where we switch to momentum input rather than input. Okay, because we talked about mass loading on Monday. And so what I computed is the